Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm very happy to have as my guest Miranda July. She's written a book of short stories published by Scribner called No One Belongs Here More Than You. She has been a performing artist, which I think is distinct from performance artist.
Yes. It is, yeah.
Would you make the distinction?
Well, it's so hard to find the right word, and I feel like when people hear performance artist, they picture something really specific that's maybe less scripted and rehearsed and sort of play-like. And yet I am performing, and so I have to get that word in there. So, you know, no one ever sticks to that. They end up saying performance artist, but I always write performing artist.
In addition, she has written and directed and appeared in the movie Me and You and Everyone We Know, the book of stories No One Belongs Here More Than You is a collection of stories that has appeared in, among other places, McSweeney's and The New Yorker and Harper's and the Paris Review and Tin House. And, you know, usually a first collection I don't have on the show because it usually takes two or three books for a writer to define her world. But this world seems, in a way, defined by some of your previous work, and I wondered if you could describe it to me.
Yeah, I mean, I've been writing for so long, I realize, because I've been writing these performances and these first short movies and then a longer movie, and those things began quite experimental and loose and, you know, I was totally self-taught, but gradually I got more interested in narrative, and was especially in love with dialogue because I perform so much of my work that, you know, I'm doing all the roles. You know, when I'm doing a performance, I am the man, I am the young boy child. So I think that was kind of a starting place for me when I finally turn to fiction. A lot of my stories would begin with dialogue, which kind of meant beginning with acting, you know, like with, you know, not getting up and acting it out, but certainly feeling as if I was the person who was speaking.
There seems to be a real sense of, however extreme the circumstance, the people are ordinary people, and they seem to be in something of a sleepwalker's state, a little bit amazed by what's happening to them. And I was saying to a friend just yesterday that if there was something beyond the shock and numbness of Generation X, that this is, in a way, numbness without shock.
Mm.
Life is difficult. The characters seem to be saying it's hard to live. Isn't it strange and funny that we're trying anyway?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in that world, people who had maybe that kind of numbness or just ordinariness could also do somewhat daring things without even noticing that they were daring or unusual, because I always, you know, they are kind of stuck and alone and have this kind of muted quality, and yet a lot of them do, you know, things above and beyond anything that that a more daring character would usually do.
Could you describe that muted quality? Because it is there in your work. There's a kind of sedative quality in your voice in the tapes I've heard. Mm. But I would think that to capture that in prose would be the most difficult to do.
Well, I mean, I guess to some degree, you know, it's a quality in myself that that comes out when I write or that I focus on. And especially, I mean, you know, if I was to place all the stories in chronological order, you would see basically me teaching myself how to write. And I think especially the earlier ones from my, you know, mid-20s, I'm living in Portland, Oregon. I am pretty alone. Portland always had a kind of unreal quality for me. I grew up in Berkeley, like actually a bigger, in a way, more complex city. I spent a lot of time walking around and looking at people and making things up. So I think it's a lot of the stories are heavy with that feeling. And then with not having any shame about the kind of bleakness and loneliness that I grew up with, you know, that's always going to be somewhere in me, although hopefully my topics will change. There is that kind of root quality that comes into all my days, you know, no matter what I'm doing.
Yeah, you seem to really capture the imagination and voice quality of a generation. I mean, it's been a while since one would say of a writer that they've caught the feeling of life. You know, relatively few do. It's something that Salinger does. It's something that Ann Beattie did. It's, you know, it's a certain ear to the tone of life. Would you describe the world you describe?
I mean, it's funny. I mean, I can't totally, but here's some things that jumped into my head when you said that. I was thinking about my website that's just like my website, like a CV kind of, you know, all my work. And at the top of it, it says, "You obviously know what I'm talking about." And I think somewhere at the very beginning, I decided, even though I felt so strange and, you know, and like a lot of teenagers and apart from things, I decided to just assume that you knew what I was talking about and to just take that away, that any other reality out of the picture, anything other than that we both knew what I meant. And it was kind of, I think, early on felt like sort of a bluff, you know, like I so don't feel this way that maybe if I perform this strange thing as if we all know exactly what I'm talking about, then it'll work, you know, and I'll. And now I think, you know, it's been a kind of a slow surprise to realize, oh, wait, everyone is nodding, or often they are.
Now, the characters have a way of realizing that they're going to take a good long time to cross the room under certain circumstances or to get out of bed, or that they're more likely to say in their heads what they're thinking and feel the effect of having screamed it in a room, a kind of extreme fear and passivity. Do you feel that's you or our life right now?
Right. I certainly identify with that, although my friends who do have trouble getting out of bed are always looking at me and my work and saying, like, you are the single most productive person I know. And yet I feel like in some ways I am that productive because the staying in bed forever possibility seems like the flip side of that. And at any moment, it could just flip over and I could be completely paralyzed. So I think while visibly I am not that at all, I, you know, that is within me, and I do see so many people understanding all the subtle permutations of paralysis that seem to be in people's lives right now.
It seemed to me that, well, first of all, that the person who writes the books and the performance pieces does have a solution to the problems of paralysis that the characters suffer from.
Right.
That is to say that writing and making seem to be an alternative to suffering.
Right.
And I wondered how you got to the point where you could do that.
I started really young. So in a pretty serious way when I was a teenager writing plays. So it started out as an intuitive thing and then became, when I realized it couldn't always be intuitive, it became a practice. And there's a million, and there's definitely times when it doesn't happen, and that's really terrifying to me, to not be able to make things, since I'm willing to make anything in any medium.
Wow.
I'm not picky. A lot of the things I make, never see the light of day, but they helped me that day. So I think I am teaching myself always. I'm coaxing myself, as if I was someone else, to just, it's okay, kind of comforting myself, like, just try this. It'll be okay. Let's just see.
Like a coach figure.
Yeah.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Miranda July, author, most recently, of No One Belongs Here More Than You, published by Scribner. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Miranda July about her book of stories, No One Belongs Here More Than You. Now, in addition, you have a book coming out that's a documentation of another website. The website is called Learning to Love You More. It's the result of a collaboration with the activist and facilitator Harold Fletcher, and you say that one of the things that is useful is that although people think of art as being about originality and creativity, that offering assignments is often a freeing gesture if the assignments are easy enough and exciting enough. The book is called Learning to Love You More, and it's being published by Prestel. So there have been around, 63 assignments so far?
Yeah.
Give me some examples.
There's write down a recent argument that you've had, and then some of them spin off each other. So then there's one that's a video one that asks you to recreate someone else's argument. So you go take your script off the website and act out with a friend an argument that someone else, a stranger, has had. There's write your life story in less than a day. Take a picture of what you are wearing at a significant moment in your life. All different mediums, yeah.
Self-revelation seems crucial to this, almost as if the people are being asked to jump over the hurdle of whatever vulnerability they have and jump right into the making process.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like, I don't know where you know, the 5,000 people who've participated in the project, where they are in their life. But there's so many different points in your life where you might be able to go so much further if you were just told what to do in this present moment. And so I usually think that probably they did a lot of other much more interesting things after they did this assignment, but maybe that this was, you know, something that helped them in a stuck place, maybe that place of paralysis that we were talking about. And I do think, you know, there's so much kind of the idea of depression is just like weighing down on us, and antidepressants and, you know, and so much of depression, I think, is often really smart people being terrified that they're not going to be smart enough or that they're going to fail. And it's not stupid, lazy people lying around being depressed, you know. Usually, I mean, it's like there's this kind of cliche of depression, and then there's this kind of modern definition of it. And I think the assignments are in a way like, okay, forget originality for a second. Just for 2 seconds, forget being the best, you know, and blowing us all away. Just feel something. And that's simply all the website asks.
Because the stories, too, in No One Belongs Here More Than You by my guest Miranda July, they seem to offer opportunities to break out their characters who would, if pressed, regard themselves as spectacularly dull, who then surprise themselves by doing something extraordinary. It's as if inertia is paired with imagination in these stories. And I thought I would ask you to read the final paragraph of the story Making Love in 2003, because it finds a way to imagine extreme activity while the character is inert. This is Miranda July reading the final paragraph from her short story.
This morning I woke up to the sound of the neighbor trimming his tree. I told myself he would stop trimming only if I got out of bed. The tree got smaller and smaller. Soon it was just a stump, and he had to go underground and start trimming the roots, and still I could not get up. The roots were gone, and he was sawing through the earth, and I told myself that when he came out in China, I would get up. It took him all day. I wept and uncurled and curled myself in a way that I couldn't control. I was actually writhing in heartache, as if I was a single muscle whose purpose was to mourn. But by the time my neighbor hit the molten core, I was motionless. I had exhausted myself into a blank stare, a full-body examination of the ceiling. I could feel him pushing up underneath the streets of Shanghai, and to my horror, I felt hunger, the body's expression of hope. As he burst through the sky and into the Chinese air, I sat up. He plowed into the sky, upward through tree leaves and then the clouds. My neighbor sawed into outer space. He cut through the Milky Way, right through the stars and stardust. He went around the universe in a giant circle, and then he landed with a quiet thud back in his yard. I lifted the curtain and saw him putting out the sprinkler. It was dusk. If he saw me, I would live. Look up, look up, look up. He raised his eyes as if it were his own idea, and I waved.
Miranda July reading the concluding paragraph from Making Love in 2003. Now, that seemed to me to be a perfect example. The events in a story may be literally very pedestrian, but the imaginary and imaginative events are extraordinary.
Right.
As if to say we all lead these extravagant imaginative lives that we bottle and inhibit. And the stories seem to be about finding a way, often through really extended metaphors like that, to get the poetry of the inside life onto the page.
Right. I mean, I guess what it is, I always think of it as like that I'm actually a very realistic, scientific writer, and I'm just trying to scientifically, very accurately create the feeling. And that there's only, I can only do that by veering off. Like you can only see the sun, you know, or whatever by looking to the side, or a star or whatever. So I'm never even thinking it's a metaphor. You know, I'm totally believing, you know, I'm feeling it in my body.
You've been called by various people a transgressive writer, but I don't seem to respond to that at all. It's almost as if transgression has within it this desire to shock and break open. This seems like something else. The stories, as you said about Portland wanting a more normal life, the stories seem to want to be in normal forms. They would like to have beginnings, mm-hmm. middles, and ends. It's just that sometimes in order to accomplish that, or at least to conquer the gravity that's right. pulling a plot down, there have to be these bursts of extravagant mental energy.
Right.
But they're not transgressions exactly. Can you tell what you think they are?
Yeah, I know. I never I feel quite proper. In fact, when I really thought about this book coming out and tried to step back and think like, huh, I've even actually somehow written these things that people think are sexual. I just felt completely like there'd been some kind of miscommunication possibly, or that I wanted that the exact way that I intended anything transgressive or experimental in form or anything was never for the sake of that. So that, in fact, I wasn't interested in talking about that or talking to people who were interested in that, you know. That it should feel or familiar, I mean, above all.
Are you going to try and write a novel?
I think I will do that. Yeah.
Because I was wondering, you know, there's one story that's more complex in a way than the others in here. Well, there are two, actually. But the one that I loved was the one that had appeared in The New Yorker called Something That Needs Nothing. And the continuity, the extending horizontally through time of the story,
right.
just seemed very moving to me. And I wondered, was there something that in the process of working with the famously diligent and difficult editors of The New Yorker that you learned about continuity in working about on that story?
I'd love it if they were, if anyone was that helpful, although they are helpful. But, you know, that was the last story I wrote.
Was it?
For the book. In fact, I had already sold the book, so it was done. And then my editor said, you know, we could use one more story. And of course, that one just seemed impossible to write. And I couldn't write it. In fact, I wrote like six different beginnings of stories. Many of the beginnings were like six pages, you know, they got for a short story pretty deep in. They didn't go anywhere. And then it was actually Rick Moody who said, you know what, they just want pages. They want pages so the book is a little longer. So it doesn't have to be the best thing you've ever written. And so I thought, well, if they really just want pages, then I could just make this very short story that I already have into a much longer one. And that is that story. So it was already in the collection, but it ended with the scene where the cockroaches come down out of the lantern. And I knew there was more. I mean, I had the rest of that story in my head. But
Please finish this.
That was the very first, that very short story was the first one I'd ever written.
And then it became the last one.
It became also the last one.
That's fascinating. That's, to me, again, an amazing story. A girl has been having an affair with an extraterrestrial. She's written a memoir of that affair for a writing class in which her teacher has told her she's promising. Mm-hmm. She finishes the book expecting the teacher will do something now that she's finished with it. Will he send it on? Will he pat her on the head? Will he kiss her? Will it be time to change careers? And there seems to be such a willingness to take instruction from whatever happens next. I'll drive around the block until they tell me what to
right,
do.
Right.
Is that the way you are?
No. It's funny. I mean, I'm incredibly proactive, and I also hate authority. You know, I've never been in a writing class. But I would like to not be that way. I would like to be taken care of and told what to do. You know, if I had it within myself to let that happen. So it's really fun to get to be that person, you know, and express that part of myself that just won't come out, you know.
Well, that's great. So in other words, the freed character comes naturally to you. It's the character who feels the inhibition, who remains behind on the page?
I mean, I guess it's all me to me, you know, but it just happens to do the work that I do. I have to not be that way. But there's a lot of other things that I, you know, can't do at all. I mean, I'm not an intrepid traveler. This is the thing. This is the area that moves easily. Yeah, so it's not a huge stretch of the imagination.
I've been speaking with Miranda July, author most recently of No One Belongs Here More Than You. The sampling of the response to the exercises on her website with Harold Fletcher, Learning to Love You More, is being published soon by Prestel Books. And No One Belongs Here More Than You is published by Scribner. Thank you, Miranda, for joining me.
Thank you so much, Michael.
You can read an excerpt from No One Belongs Here More Than You at kcrw.com/bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.